We do pick up again with our series on the Exodus and the Determined to Deliver with Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 through 25. Let's hear now the word of the Lord this morning. In the Pew Bibles, it's on page 88 if you would like. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away. But Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Rule asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave him his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Friends, this is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, there's a TV show coming back that I'd hazard to guess that many of us have seen in the past. Do you remember the show, What Would You Do? It's a hidden camera show on ABC where host John Quiñones and a group of actors stage scenes of injustice and discrimination and see what it takes to get people to intervene. For instance, in one episode, some women are at a beauty salon not realizing that one of them is an actress. And that actress starts running her mouth and getting really mean. She starts complaining about the Asian girl who's doing her nails, though the girl doesn't know English much and can't even defend herself. She says some horribly mean, horribly racist kinds of things. The question is, what will the others do? Will they laugh at her cruel jokes or just try to ignore them? Will they stand up for this immigrant or just look the other way? As you watch, you want to think people will act. You want to think people will defend this poor lady. But many don't, or their action is sadly delayed. In another episode, an elderly woman plays the role of a cashier at a grocery store. But when she has trouble working the scanner, a young man gets impatient. He starts muttering about how ridiculous it is to have to wait for grandma to figure out how to use the computer. "She should be in a nursing home," he says. "Come on, old lady, sometime this century." But again, the question is, what will the other customers do? How long will they tolerate his disrespect and his bullying? And again, the answer is sadly much longer than you would think. Eventually, some people do step up, but many just stay silent and pretend it's not their business. They say nothing. They do nothing to intervene. And let me give you a third example as well. In yet another episode of this show, two guys go up to a girl in a restaurant bar, and they start to flirt with her, and they order her a drink. She plays along, all giggly and naive, and then excuses herself to go to the bathroom. But while she's away, they grind up some pills and put them in her drink. Other people see it. The camera catches them. But what will they do? Will they call these guys out or at least warn her before she drinks? You think everybody would, but these guys are intimidating, and sadly, most people don't dare to confront them there that day. Not even when the girl acts drowsy and they start to lead her away. So why do I share this? Well, because these situations, while disturbing, are not all that foreign to us. We've all seen some similar kinds of things. Situations of abuse, neglect, and prejudice, and all kinds of injustice. Stuff that's clearly wrong, that should not be happening. Maybe you heard your coworker make racist comments about that new guy at work, but you froze. You just couldn't say anything. Maybe you saw some kids bullying a kid at school or in your cabin up at summer camp this summer, but you didn't dare to stop them or tell the counselor what was happening. Maybe you visited a senior whose children's lack of attention really borders on neglect. But you didn't dare to confront them. You didn't dare to wade in. Or maybe you noticed strange bruises on your sister's arm again, but you didn't have the guts to ask her about it. Oh, it'll just make matters worse. And your relationship with her has always been complicated. Stuff happens. We live in a broken, a sin-sick world. And sometimes we witness savage, violent, not nice things. But when we do we dare to look? Do we dare to care? Do we dare to do something about it? Or do we just wash our hands? Well, that's not my business, anyways. What would you do if you saw a friend or family member who was abusing another? Or what if it's just strangers? Would you do the same thing? We all want to believe we'd be the hero, but it takes courage to step in. Because you might take the hits then, take the heat. Am I my brother's keeper? Is it really worth the risk? Well, our passage today is a lot like watching three of these What Would You Do episodes. Because here we get to see Moses in three of these awful situations. Three times the adult Moses witnesses cases of abuse and violence of the strong, oppressing and humiliating the weak. And he has to decide, what will he do, if anything? In the first case, he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And Moses, as we know, is Hebrew by birth. But he's been raised in Pharaoh's house, and he's been educated Egyptian. And so we wonder, what will weigh heavier on him, the concerns of his empire, his power and privilege, or the basic needs of his own people? His Egyptian culture and comforts, or his Hebrew identity? Twice the text says that Moses went out and saw the suffering of his own people. His own people. How does he know he's Hebrew? Well, we're not told here, but somehow by age 40, he's figured it out. But you get the sense that this isn't the first time that he's seen this injustice. This isn't the first time that he's felt his blood start to boil. And this time he can't stand it. He just can't stand it no more. What he does is so shocking, though, that some of have accused Moses of being a hothead or a brash young man. I wonder, though, if that's the way the Bible pictures him here. Because notice, before he kills this Egyptian, he looks this way and that. And afterwards, he's still thinking clearly enough to hide the body in the sand. This wasn't just a crime of passion, but a deliberate move. He's determined to strike him, if not kill him. We all know that two wrongs don't make a right, though, and Moses broke the sixth commandment that God's going to give him. Do not murder. That one had been obvious ever since Cain. But the action Moses takes here is not for himself, but to defend his brother, And in fact, the verb to strike here is the same verb used when God himself later strikes the Egyptians with plagues. When you threaten his people, God won't stay neutral. In fact, I'm not going to leap to Moses' defense here. Most commentators don't, but they simply make peace with the fact that God can use even murderers, of course. But following Pastor Cindy's lead from last week, I followed a cross-reference to the book of Isaiah, where some Jewish rabbis claimed that the very same phrase, "and seeing that there was no one when Moses looked this way and that," is actually used of God, too, in a very different, not a dodgy kind of way. As Isaiah writes, "The Lord looked and was displeased that there was no justice. He saw that there was no one. He was appalled that there was no one to intervene. So his own arm achieved salvation for him, and his own righteousness sustained him." We presume guilt. We assume that verse 12 here means that Moses premeditated this murder. Why look this way and that? Because he wanted to make sure the coast was clear, right? And nobody was going to see. But it's just as possible that he did see others there, and yet none of them would stick their necks out for that defenseless slave. No one would stand up. No one would intervene. And if that's true, it gives us a fascinating read into Moses' character, into Moses' true quality. Why the Lord saw this murderer and said, "This is the one I'll call to lead." Because unlike the oppressors and the oppressed here, Moses will step up and stand up for justice, even if he's the only one standing. And yes, even if it will cost him dearly. But then we get to the second episode here, and the injustice turns inward. Now it's Hebrew against Hebrew. Slaves treating each other like dirt. IRO, internalized racial oppression. But again, Moses steps in and breaks up the fight, pointing out that the one in the wrong is the one who's resorted to violence, the one who's been striking, hitting the other, who's taking out his anger, his aggression on his brother. Sometimes we don't know where to go with our anger at others' cruelty. So we look for easy targets. We turn to those closest to home. Ask yourself now, are you really fighting with your mom? Are you really blaming your brother? Or could you be transferring the wrongs that others have done to you onto them, onto safer targets? Why are you hitting your own, your fellow Hebrew? Moses wonders. In fact, it reminds me of this time that I was a camp counselor and these two kids kept fighting, and I just couldn't stop them. Every time I turned around, they'd be calling each other names. They'd just be hitting and blaming one another. The trouble was, the two of them were cousins, actual cousins, so they thought that they had a right to go that way without me getting in the way of them. They thought they had a right to fight with each other. Man, you don't know what he's like. I'd knock him flat back in Chicago. But then one Sunday, one of them made the mistake of calling the other the N-word. And Reverend B. Campbell overheard it. And he rounded on those two boys there like thunder. "Do you even know what that word means?" he said. "What our people have been through to overcome the hatred that's behind that word? You wouldn't let a white boy call you that. How can you say that to your brother?" But when Moses steps in here, it's not so popular. It's not so powerful. "Who are you to judge us?" the man spits back. "You don't know what it's like. You live in a palace. You're not a slave." And in that instant, he realizes that the very people he's trying to help might not want his help. They might not follow his lead. They'll turn him into Pharaoh soon. And so he has to flee. But before we think that Moses has given up on justice, the Bible then gives us this third episode here in Midian. where again Moses steps up and comes to the aid of all the weak. In verse 17, he sees a group of shepherd men harassing some women and preventing them from watering their father's flocks. So he drives them away, even though he's a fugitive in their country. And notice their father's question, "How have you come home so early today?" he asks his seven daughters. Clearly, this was a pattern. These men harassed them every day. But though it might alienate him still further, Moses can't let it go. He can't live in a world where that kind of wrong goes unchecked. He identifies with the oppressed and rescues them, the text says. See, it doesn't matter if it's Egyptian against Hebrew, Hebrew against Hebrew, or foreign men against foreign women. Moses is burning for justice here. He is going to intervene. Not only does he have eyes to see and hands to act, but a heart that knows the pain of the outcasts. He's moved and moves to take their suffering here personally. Moses' concern for justice transcends the boundaries of nation, gender, and race. It extends to all who are threatened, to all who are weak. And he calls for intolerance, intolerance of abuse, intolerance of violence, intolerance of the tyranny of the strong, and a costly courage to stand up for the weak. But do you see what God is doing then? God is preparing Moses here to deliver his people and to win over their trust. By giving him the experience of being rejected and oppressed. Think of all that Moses had lost here. He's gone from Prince of Egypt in Pharaoh's palace to a rejected fugitive out in the scrublands here, the boondocks. Because God wants him to know from experience what it's like to be foreign and to be hated. "I have become a stranger in a strange land," he says at the end of our text. He's identified with the outcasts. He's fully entered their struggle now. And that, of course, goes for more than Moses as well, because at the end of chapter 2, our text turns heavenward, and we see that God himself has eyes to see and hands to act and a heart that knows his people's struggle. God is moved and moving, yet he remembers his covenant. The last two verses are the most important ones in this chapter. "During that long period the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them." The NIV says God was concerned, but do you know what the original Hebrew says there? It says that God knew, that God yada. Not in an abstract, theoretical kind of knowledge, but in a personal, relational way. God knew here from experience. God saw the children of Israel and he knew. And see, that's good news, really, because it means he knows their cries. He knows our misery, our pain. He knows them from the inside out, even. He's identified with them, not just in Moses, but in Jesus. You see, when Moses sees injustice, he has a passion, he has a compassion to respond. He will act. He will stick his neck out here, no matter the cost. But friends, the good news is that God is like that too. In Jesus, he came down from all his power and privilege. He was rejected. He was forsaken by his own. He was even nailed to a cross. He humbled himself to death, so he knows the cries of our hearts. Exodus 2, verse 11, "Moses went out to his own people, but received no welcome from them." John 1, verse 11, Jesus came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Both Moses and Jesus were rejected by their own, but welcomed by outsiders. And so they learned to stand with the marginalized and to stand up for them also, no matter the cost. But all this begs the question, who are we then if we call ourselves Christians? What would we do in these cases? What would Jesus do? How intolerant was he of injustice? Can we stand by and watch other people enslaved and destroying each other with all the effects of their sin? Can we stay aloof, or do we have to intervene? In many ways, we live in an age where people are quick to judge, but rather slow to take action. We take opinion as truth, and we mistake niceness for grace. We see an evil, but say nothing to confront it. We hear of a wrong, but say, oh, well, that's not my problem. We excuse ourselves unless it's right there in our face. But that's neither truthful nor is it gracious. People are hurting. People who we know. Can we really stand by, let them live in all that pain? What will we do? Keep a stiff neck or stick our necks out and take some of the heat for one another? Can you be moved to move or just look the other way? Remember that episode about the elderly cashier who was struggling with the computer problems, with the scanner there? Well, one lady wasn't going to stand by and let that guy just run his mouth. So she cut into him like a mama bear defending her cub. You don't know this woman. You don't know that it's her fault. You don't know how hard it is for seniors in our culture who want to retire, sometimes don't have enough. You remember that episode with the two men who were hitting on and trying to drug that poor girl? The fact is, not everybody was spineless in that crowd. Now, one guy calmly walked out and called the cops, then took off his sweater, tied up the doors with it, and actually barricaded the exit. They'd have to get through him before they escaped justice. You might say that's just human decency, that's just common grace that every one of us would share. Maybe that's true. But you see, as Christians, we have double the reason to stand up. Not only do we know that all people are made in God's image and so have dignity and are deserving of respect, but we know a God who stood up for us, is even to death itself. Just like Moses, Jesus came down from his palace and he saw his people's misery and oppression, our abuse and our neglect, our dreadful slavery to sin. And he was moved to lay aside all his power and privilege, all his safe, good standing, and to become a foreigner of foreigners, to fully identify with the poor, with the weak, and the oppressed. And then he stood up. He went to battle against the real tyrant, the real oppressor. Let my people go, he demanded of the devil and of sin. Do you see that that was no shout from the sidelines there, no pittance from the powerful, but a cry from the cross? He suffered the greatest injustice, yet freely gave us his life. Friends, when we see the move that God has made for us, how can we not move like that for others? God makes this his business. How can we not make it ours? If we don't see anybody hurting, then maybe we've got to come down more from our comfort and our privilege and get to know more brothers and sisters till we see and hear and are moved to help out. If you're looking for a way right now, then I want to urge you to come back here after the service this morning for our adult ed time here today. Cameron Connor is here from Together West Michigan. He's been doing just this fantastic job organizing neighborhood walks here in our neighborhood, amplifying the cries of our neighbors here in this community. They're asking questions like, what kinds of things keep you up at night? What are your priorities? What cries against injustice can we raise together with one voice? I hope Cameron will share with you his story too, because God called him to this work from a small town in eastern Washington where the factories all closed, devastating the workforce and his family. But Cameron shared with me this quote from Walter Brueggemann this week. It says this: "Where the cry is not voiced, heaven is not moved, and history is not initiated. The end is hopelessness. But where the cry is seriously voiced, heaven may answer and earth may have a new chance. The new resolve in heaven and the new possibility on earth depend on the initiation of protest." Friends, the Israelites groaned, and they cried out here, and they cried for help, and they moaned, and their cries rose up to God. So what did God do? God heard. God remembered. God saw them. And God came down to know. "Go and do likewise, and he will move heaven and earth." Let's pray together. Lord, our world is hurting. Our world is hurting in just so very many ways. There's so much injustice that we feel powerless to stop. But give us this faith of Moses to take a stand for all those made in your image, just as you, Lord, took a stand for us. In Jesus' name we ask this, and for your kingdom, God's people say together,